wanna give love to the city, that's a fact. But you're gonna need help if you wanna make an impact.
Well endowed,
you want to be
well endowed
with the Edmonton community.
Things really happen when you find that you're well endowed.
Welcome to the Well Endowed Podcast, brought to you by Edmonton Community Foundation.
I'm Elizabeth Bonking.
And I'm Andrew Paul. In this month's episode, we'll get our hands dirty with the Edmonton and Area Land Trust as they rescue several native Alberta plants from a highway expansion. We'll meet some intrepid canoers making a splash to celebrate Canada's 150th. And we'll chat with Emmy Steubing about how her legacy of giving in Edmonton will continue even after she moves to Victoria. But first, Dr. Bukola Salami shares her research about the health of newcomers to Canada.
On our previous episode, we discussed the 2016 Vital Signs Report and its focus on newcomers. We're pleased that Dr. Bukola Salami was able to join us for our launch of the report, and we invited her to speak to the Well Endowed podcast about her research into immigrants' health in Canada. Let's take a listen to what Bukola had to say.
So my name is Dr. Bukola Salami. I'm an assistant professor at the Faculty of Nursing, University of Alberta. I've lived in Canada now since 1997. I immigrated from Nigeria and I started as a faculty in 2014. My research is in the area of immigrant health. So in the past, I've done research studies on the health of temporary foreign workers. I've done studies on parenting practices of immigrants and also the mental health of immigrants in Canada, and the integration of internationally educated nurses into the system.
In our Vital Signs report, we talk a little bit about how newcomer health is extremely good when they come into the country, because there's some high standards for choosing the newcomers that are coming here. But shortly afterwards, their health starts to decline. And that's what we want to talk about, is what's happening there. So thank you, Bukola, for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Referencing this statistic in Vital Signs, why do you think newcomer health overall is better than Canadians?
Like you said, I think it's because of the selection factors that we have for newcomers coming to Canada. So we know there's around 250,000 to 300,000 permanent residents that come to Canada every year. They are often screened. So, for example, if they have a history of current cancer, tuberculosis, we don't normally allow people with disabilities to come to Canada. Now, that is different for refugees. Refugees we do allow, but we know refugees only constitute a fraction of all newcomers in Canada. So if we look at newcomers in general, including refugees, immigrants' health, the health of immigrants, it's better in Canada in the initial years in Canada, and that's called the healthy immigrant effect. Now, the healthy immigrant effect, it's the most popularly known term within immigrant health, and it's not just in Canada. It's been documented in other countries too.
You had mentioned that it doesn't include the refugees, and in fact, we do want to make the point that here in Edmonton, the refugee population is 0.16. It's not even 1% of the population. So it is a very small portion of our population. And so really, we're talking about immigrants in general when we're talking about this statistic. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, we are talking about immigrants in general. The research that has been done on the LD immigrant effect, It generally looks at people that are permanent residents. So it does include refugees that have become permanent residents, but it doesn't usually include refugee claimants that have not yet become permanent residents. But as you said, they're less than 1%.
Yeah,
so by the
so
time
small.
You combine permanent residents with immigrants, it's so small that then the strong health of permanent residents does overshadow differences within groups of immigrants.
Is it just their physical health that is better overall, or is it mental health that's included in that?
It's both physical health and mental health. So we know that immigrants arrive in Canada, as I said earlier, and after 5 to 10 years, their health declines. And sometimes for some health indicators becomes even much worse than Canadians. So that includes mental health. So I'm doing a study now. We are analyzing data from 17,000 people on the mental health of immigrants and non-immigrants in Canada. Part of what we found is that people in their first 5 years in Canada, self-reported mental health is better than Canadians. But we know that after 10 years, it becomes worse or equivalent to Canadians after 10 years. So we do see healthy immigrant effect also reflected in mental health status. And we can talk about, you know, many reasons that may contribute to that.
Yeah, and I want to explore that a little bit. 10 years seems to be the magic number. What happens to individuals after 10 years? Do they become Canadianized and eat lots of junk food like the rest of us? Or are there other factors?
The analysis of the database that I looked at, there was a strong influence of community belonging and also income status on mental health. So if you feel like you belong to a community, you're more likely to rate your mental health as better. If your income is better, you're more likely. But we know that a lot of immigrants come here and they experience de-skilling within the profession. They come with high hopes and they experience stress in being able to access the profession. And there's also being able to connect with, you know, community resources and the cultural competence too of the system and receptivity towards immigrants.
So do you think there's some racism there, or do you think it's just it's other barriers, language, just the ability to connect to the right people?
Well, if we look at the broader social determinants of health, we can talk about income, employment, underemployment as a social determinant of health. But even underlying these trends and issues, too, is the systemic racism in the system that prevents people in the first round from being able to access employment for which they are qualified to do. For example, we know from research that when two people apply for the same job, they've done research where they've had two people apply for the same job and all they changed is the name. So two resumes but with a different name, and you have a better success when the name is more European than when it, you know, sounds like it's from Asia or Africa. So of course, you know, when there's this systemic barriers, it does contribute to immigrants' ability to gain employment. And of course, if immigrants are not able to gain employment, then income is affected. And there are several pathways that income does contribute to health. We know that many of the challenges related to health, you know, disease is less than 20% of the causes of health. The main causes are this broader social determinant of health, like income, physical environment, social environment.
One of the other things that was different for newcomers is maternal health.
The main thing related to maternal health, strong indicators that immigrant postpartum depression among immigrant women is higher than Canadian-born women. And again, you know, it's the issue about isolation. I'm talking to some parents. They are talking about the fact that, you know, back home, you know, if they give birth, there's like 10,000 people around them to help them. But in Canada, we are a little bit more individualistic in our approach. And because of that, there is not as much support. They may not be connected well. And then there's the cultural competence of healthcare professionals. So postpartum depression is a major issue that researchers have been trying to tackle among immigrant women in Canada, including refugee women too in Canada, also experience a higher rate of postpartum depression.
Does language play a factor there too, especially with the newest of our newcomers? If they come pregnant or if they become pregnant soon after arriving, being able to communicate with a healthcare professional in an adequate way?
Yes, language contributes to access to healthcare for immigrants, and immigrants often experience challenges in being able to access healthcare because sometimes they are not skilled in English. And there are some immigrants that are skilled in French, but then the healthcare system is not as responsive to people that are skilled in French. So language is a big factor, and accessibility to interpreter services sometimes is very, very limited, especially one-on-one and trained interpreters. It's not a surprise within some healthcare settings that family members are often called on to do interpretation service. And oftentimes when what happens when family members are called on is there are differences in terms of truth-telling regions, and they may not, you know, tell the whole truth about the specific condition. And then there's the complexity, too, in terms of interpreting something that is said in medical jargons, with medical jargons, rather than interpreting day-to-day words. So access to interpreter services has been shown to contribute to better health outcomes for immigrant populations.
I've heard that story before that, you know, the mom goes in with the son who speaks better English, but the son doesn't want to translate everything that the doctor is saying to the mom,
yeah.
Just because it's either embarrassing or something that he wouldn't normally say at home, right?
Yeah.
So it becomes a very difficult situation.
Yeah, or, you know, imagine if a child is doing the interpretation and you're like, you know, she's going to die of cancer. There are some cultures that prioritize the emotional well-being of the person.
Right.
And sometimes I'm over telling the truth. So in terms of protection, a person may choose to not tell the truth over that ethical commitment to protect the person emotionally.
So, yeah, I think we've touched on a lot of things, but I do want to hit on one more topic, if you don't mind.
That's okay.
And that's seniors. And we know that there are more and more newcomers coming to Canada now. And in another 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to have a lot of seniors that have some different levels of English. How is our care for seniors going to have to change?
Well, I think seniors, that is a place that, you know, I've seen a lot of research done on postpartum, on immigrant women's health. A few are being done on children, especially immigrant youth, but there's not been as much about immigrant seniors. Now, there is a wave of new research coming out from Toronto, and we are just beginning to see it here in Edmonton, see a lot in terms of immigrants. And as you correctly point out, we are having an aging population, and there are challenges in terms of addressing seniors' health, including the issue of isolation, the issue about being able to speak the language. And whether we like it or not, you know, we should also be sensitive to the issue about elder abuse. Domestic violence is one thing, but there's also elder abuse that we have to attend to related to immigrant population. And there's thinking about how immigration policies structure seniors' health, immigrant seniors' health. So I think there is a lot that needs to be done in terms of that. There are some community agencies that are already having like community forums, small groups for immigrant seniors. And I think more and more we need to create avenues and channel and basis for seniors to come together and support each other to foster or contribute to a better well-being for seniors.
So connectivity is a really big thing.
I think connectivity with an immigrant population. I was just doing, to shed light on our mental health project, we were just doing some interviews over the last 1 week on how to contribute to community belonging. And people talked about the importance of religious organizations within immigrant groups in terms of community belonging. And people also talked about creating those natural environments for people to just come together. So those parenting programs does seem that all you're learning is how to parent your child, but it also helps you in terms of connecting with other women and being able to foster a sense of, you know, belonging and inclusion within the Canadian society.
To end on one last note, if you were the average Canadian, probably born here, what can you do to improve newcomers' health?
There is a lot that you can do. There is, you know, volunteer opportunities. But I think the key ingredient in being culturally aware, culturally sensitive and competent, is actually having that self-awareness of who am I as a person, who am I as a Canadian, what are my values, and how does those values contribute to the relationships that I form. So I think if at the most basic level, that if I'm to tell any Canadian anything, is really, really be aware and discover who they are as Canadian, because you need to discover yourself to be able to know the other.
That's great advice. Thank you so much, and thank you for being here with us. We were just listening to my conversation with Dr. Bukola Salami, an assistant professor at the University of Alberta. Thanks very much to Bukola for sharing more about her research with us. What's next, Andrew?
Grab your jacket, Elizabeth. We're heading out to the garden to meet a team of conservationists from the Edmonton and Area Land Trust. Last month, they rescued a number of native plant species from a highway expansion project northeast of Edmonton. I caught up with them as they were digging a new home for the rescued flora behind our offices.
My name is Rebecca Ellis, and I'm the project coordinator for the Edmonton Area Land Trust. We're creating a pollinator garden with rescued plants from a highway expansion northeast of Edmonton. And we're doing this in partnership with the Edmonton Native Plant Group to create a garden at the Edmonton Community Foundation. Our original plan was to dig up the site at the ECF last week, a few days ago. But then we got wind that the plants, the particular site that we were going to be working at, would likely already be dug up. They would already be working on the highway expansion at that particular site. So we had to quickly change our plans, and we rescued the plants a few days earlier than we thought we would. And so today we've been preparing the garden site, and we'll be planting them as well. All the plants that we have here today are native plants, mostly wildflowers that you might see on the side of the road. Some of them include three-flowered avens, different types of goldenrod, and asters as well. The Edmonton Community Foundation has a really nice backyard. The place where we put the garden gets quite a bit of sun, and so these plants will get enough sun that they need in order to thrive. We also are putting it right next to a bee hotel that is also at the Edmonton Community Foundation, which we installed there last year. Conserving the native habitats in our province and around Edmonton is important for wildlife biodiversity and for protection of natural areas, and that is the core of what the Edmonton and Area Land Trust does. The Edmonton and Area Land Trust is a nonprofit, and we've been working in the Edmonton region for around 8 years. Our main mandate is to conserve and protect natural areas. Right now we have 7 properties, totaling about 1,300 acres. Properties are in areas almost making a circle around Edmonton, and they're quite varied. We have 3 properties in the Cooking Lake Moraine natural region or natural area, which is east of Edmonton around Cooking Lake, Elk Island, Miquelon Lake, that sort of area. That area and our properties there are important for wildlife habitat, for waterfowl breeding habitat, and that type of thing. We have other properties that are in areas where it's a bit more boreal forest. So you find some different species there. You sometimes tend to find more of a spruce muskeg type of vegetation community, whereas in other ones you find more of a parkland, aspen, poplar trees, and that kind of those kinds of vegetation there. The public can visit all of our properties, and that's one thing that we've tried to value and to emphasize and to encourage people to go and visit our properties. They're all listed on our website, and several of them have a good trail system, which makes it pretty easy to find your way around and enjoy the property. And we want to make sure that people can do that, because a lot of people seem to think that to be outside, to be in a wild place, you need to go to the mountains when you live in Edmonton, but you actually don't need to go that far. All of our properties are within an hour's drive, and you can go there and visit and just spend time being outside for a day. You can find information on our website at eALT.ca. The primary ways that you can get involved are by donating or volunteering. We are a nonprofit, and so donations are very important to us to receive financial support from our donors. And volunteers are just as important as well. We have volunteer opportunities throughout the year, and they vary from coming out with us to our properties, working in the field, to jobs that you can even do from home. So depending on your skills, there's lots of ways to get involved, and you can sign up to do so on our website.
Thanks to Rebecca Ellis for joining us. We're looking forward to stopping and smelling the wildflowers next summer, and I'm sure our guests in the Bee Hotel will appreciate them too. Our next story takes us into the wilds of Edmonton's River Valley.
The wilds?
Well, with the size of the coyotes we can boast about, I stand by that description. Our producer, Lisa Pruden, joins us again with a story about a very cool project that celebrates Canada's 150th birthday in a way that unites us with our current environment and our history.
The Voyager Brigade Society is working with many organizations, both locally and across Canada, to plan a special canoe brigade to celebrate Canada's 150th. I had the privilege to speak with Mark Lund and Chris Thrall about the project, but first, here's Craig Stumpf-Allen.
My name is Craig Stumpf-Allen. I am the Director of Grants at the Edmonton Community Foundation.
To talk about the Community Fund for Canada's 150th.
It's a small grants program that's done in partnership with Heritage Canada, Community Foundations of Canada and local community foundations. And it's meant to be an opportunity for a wide variety of organizations to get involved in celebrating Canada's 150th. They have three big priorities, which are about inspiring a deeper understanding of Canada's history, engaging a wide variety of people in celebrations, and encouraging participation in celebrations. There are certainly criteria that people have to match, but there's quite a variety of projects that would be eligible or have been funded. ECF, for example, has funded some multicultural pop-up events. We've funded a concert of Canadian music through Edmonton Musical Theatre. And we've also funded a gathering of Aboriginal and refugees as a means to celebrate Canada with those two diverse communities. That's through Bent Arrow. We had an intake in September, and we're just in the process of reviewing those applications now, and they should find out next month whether they were successful. And we've decided that we'll be having a third intake that will run from December 1st to January 15th for projects starting after about March 1st.
Craig also took some time to share a little more information about the Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade.
So this one is a little bit unusual because it's actually one piece of a national project. The 2017 Canadian Voyageur Brigade Society is setting up a series of canoe brigades across Canada, and the River Valley Alliance, which is actually an environmental organization, is one of the partners here in Edmonton. And what they're doing is a five-day brigade to connect people to Canada Day celebrations, teach people about the history of voyageurs, teach people about the environment of the River Valley, and they're also making a special effort to engage in Aboriginal youth to teach people about the involvement of Indigenous people in that era. So it's an interesting collaboration which touches on historical stuff, environmental stuff, recreational stuff, cultural stuff. It's very wide-reaching. So when I talked earlier about the priorities of the program to engage diverse communities, teach people about our history, and celebrate the 150th, this one touches on all three of those.
There is a very rich history to explore through the Voyageurs, reaching into Indigenous and early European heritage. It is a perfect opportunity to discover our shared history. Nationally, some of the brigades are making a direct link to further reconciliation. The Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade itself has funds set aside especially for an Indigenous crew. Here are Mark Lund and Chris Thrall to talk more about their plan for the Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade.
I'm Mark Lund, and I'm kind of the old guy around paddling here in Edmonton. I've been here since I came up to university in 72, and in 78 we started the Kiana Canoe Club. And here we are getting ready for 2017, Canada's 150th.
Oh, my name is Chris Thrall. I'm the new outreach manager for the River Valley Alliance. Our mandate is to protect, preserve, and enhance the River Valley, encourage people to get down here and enjoy the outdoor activity here. And we partnered up with Mark to help find the grant sponsorship for this Canada 150 project of the Voyageur Canoe Paddle.
In answering what is the Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade, let me explain that it is part of the 2017 Canadian Voyageur Brigades.
The 2017 Canadian Voyageur Brigades will include brigades in all regions across Canada throughout the summer of 2017. The Fort Edmonton Brigade will begin on June 29th, setting out from just above Devon and ending in Victoria Settlement on July 3rd. There has been a great deal of collaboration between organizations across Canada in order to organize these paddling voyages.
There is some overlap there between a number of different Canada 150 projects as well. There's a coordinator in Fort St. John who is reaching out to all the Canadian heritage rivers to try and organize sort of a cross-Canada branded initiative talking about Canada's heritage rivers and their importance to us and just how important they are to our civilizations, to our cities, and to our rural environment.
Alberta boasts four heritage rivers, the Athabasca River, Clearwater River, Fraser River, and of course the North Saskatchewan River. Voyageurs traveled these rivers to transport goods during the fur trade era from about 1690 to 1850. The canoes they would travel on are often called North Canoes,
which you will hear Mark mention in just a moment. These canoes were about 34 feet long and 60 inches wide. Wherever the water became too dangerous for the canoe, the voyageurs would need to go overland, a portage. This meant carrying the canoes and all of their food, gear, and goods through the wilderness. The going would have been tough, to say the least, but luckily the Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade for Canada's 150 will have some modern adjustments.
The Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade, like most of our brigades, is running on about a 5 to 8 day schedule. That seems to be the most common length. We have some longer ones. There are some limiting factors in a brigade. Campsites, boat availability, and there's going to be lots of competition for boats next year. So for the Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade, I expect to have about 10 of the fur trade era replica canoes and about 100 paddlers.
About 100 people in the water is kind of a misnomer as well, because there is a lot of support that comes all the way along as well. Mark was commenting about the different camping sites, etc., and there has been community support gathering together at these different camping sites. So when they get off the water in Devon and we have a celebration and a potluck lunch and everything along these lines, we get into Edmonton, we're going to have another big celebration. We get into Fort Saskatchewan, we're going to have another big celebration and camping overnight across the river. So a number of different communities have come together to support these this Voyager style exploration, the Fort Edmonton Brigade, and it's going to be exciting at each stop all the way along this trip.
Here's what Mark and Chris hope you experience with the Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade.
The big thing, of course, is there's six of you in a boat. They're a tremendous social experience. It's not like getting into a kayak and paddling all by yourself with nobody to talk to. You get to make a very strong connection with your crew, and especially if you're traveling across the country for many days or even weeks.
What we really hope for is that you find that connection with our 150 plus another 150 easily years of experience with the European interaction with North America. Navigable rivers was really the predominant form of transportation throughout North America at the time. The engagement with the Aboriginal communities along the ways. Finding that connection in a modern society is rare enough, and getting out on the river, getting a little bit of that peace and quiet, and really connecting with the land along our heritage river system. If you're not up for joining one of the brigades, then there are a couple of other things that you can do to get involved too. Take out your canoe, take out your kayak, come paddle along with this trip, because it's going to be quite an event, especially as it enters into, say, Devon, say, Edmonton, say, Fort Saskatchewan. If you don't feel like being on the water, be part of the crowds that are cheering us on over the bridges and cheering us on as we get there. Join us for dinner and just celebrate Canada's Heritage River, the North Saskatchewan River Valley, and just enjoy yourself like that.
Big thanks to Mark Lund and Chris Thrall for telling us about that amazing paddling community, not only here in Edmonton, but across Canada. What a perfect way to celebrate Canada's 150th birthday. Mark Lund is a primary organizer of the Fort Edmonton Canoe Brigade. Chris Thrall is the outreach manager for the River Valley Alliance and would love nothing more than to see people out having fun in the River Valley.
And thanks again to our colleague, Craig Stumpf-Allen, for telling us more about the Community Fund for Canada's 150th. If you would like more information about any of those organizations and about the project we just talked about, you can find hyperlinks on our website at thewellendowedpodcast.com.
For our final story today, we want to introduce you to one of our amazing donors. Emmy Stubing has been a dedicated and generous member of the Edmonton community, not just as a donor, but also as a volunteer and through her work as well. And by the time you're hearing this interview, unfortunately, she'll be starting a whole new adventure in Victoria, BC. Emmy and I sat down to discuss what giving in Edmonton has meant to her and what it'll continue to mean after her transition to her new city.
My name is Emmy Stubing, and I am a lifelong volunteer and enthusiastic member of the community. I like to keep busy doing all kinds of things, but I have built my career in working for various charities as a fundraiser, but I also love to be a donor as well.
Why did you start your fund, Emmy?
Well, I've spent my whole career working for charities, so I kind of got the inside scoop on what the Edmonton Community Foundation was all about from the flip side of it, from organizations that were benefiting from the various funds in the ECF. I I could really see the benefits and the long-term outcomes of endowment funds. And in talking with some of the people who've become friends of mine through the ECF, yes. Who advised me, the donor advisors, I found out you don't have to just make a gigantic lump sum donation, that it's something that's very manageable for regular people like me. And when I looked at how much I was donating to various charities on my own each year anyway, I realized I could afford to do this. So I decided to stop spreading out all my donations, my annual gifts to different causes throughout the year for a period of time, and just devoted all to building my own endowment fund. And I set a goal, and I was very excited to achieve that goal, reach that target about a year and a half earlier than I had expected. And now that it's great. Active, it's been really exciting to be able to start to hand out gifts to various causes. So that's basically how it all started for me.
Just a couple things that you had mentioned was the word endowment, mm-hmm. Which is basically, you know, invested funds that mm-hmm. The interest is given back every year and the principal's never spent. And also you talked about that your fund was able to give, that it had reached its maximum. So
yes.
Edmonton Community Foundation has a threshold of $10,000 before mm-hmm. it starts to give. So what about an endowment appealed to you rather than, you know, that immediate thing that people most likely like to give to?
Yeah, it's the perpetuity of it. It's the fact that it's going to go on forever. That turned me on.
<That's great. laughs>
I get excited about strange things, apparently. I realized that, okay, I have 10 years to reach that $10,000 mark. That's $1,000 a year. I'm giving about that already. It wasn't going to be too much of a stretch to achieve that. And to know that my fund, will go on well after I'm gone and keep making a difference, it excited me. I have to admit that sometimes I felt a little bit badly because I did have to scale back my instant gratification,
right.
my annual gifts that I was making to the various causes throughout the year. But I just said, this is what I'm focusing on. I believe in your cause, but this will be a longer term investment, and stay tuned because you might get something down the road from my fund. So I did have to say no and cut back, but I think it was all worth it.
And in the end, you were able to direct your funds wherever you'd like. That's
wherever.
How you set up your fund.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now that I work at the library and we have a big campaign underway, I've been directing, this year I directed all of my proceeds from my fund to the library. And like I say, my fund started with $10,000. And so the interest from that is what I get to hand out. And the check just arrived this past week. Interestingly enough, one of my colleagues came to say that I just got a check from your fund. They were kind of excited to get
nice.
That. And I think the check was for just under $600, something like that, which is great. And I know that as the fund continues to get interest and as I continue to put into it, those annual gifts will grow. And if I want, I can give it all to one cause, such as the library right now, or I could have $50 go to 10 different charities or 12 different charities.
Right.
It's all up to me every year, and I can just decide. So it's so flexible, and it's entirely up to my interests, and I appreciate that.
So it wasn't a big stretch to imagine, waiting out the year to give your funds back to the same organization you would have anyways.
Yeah, and it's kind of like Christmas, to be honest. The almost $600 that the library got this year is more than I may have given. I'm just like, because I would have probably given, $100 here and $50 there and $25 there. So it actually is a larger gift ultimately. So
now you come from a family that likes to give back.
I grew up with parents and grandparents and great-grandparents who were all active community members involved in various boards and organizations. So it was just part of growing up and just part of being a community member and an active citizen. And I enjoy volunteering, so that's a good thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
Getting to work in this profession, I felt, was like just a dream come true. I've had wonderful role models, but this has been nice for me to sort of establish my own name, I guess, and sort of do Emmy Steubing, I did this myself. And it's one of the things I'm most proud of.
Well, I think one of the things that is associated with you in a very positive way is that you're so young.
Yeah.
Most people assume that to do an endowment fund, you need to be old and rich. But that's not the case, is it?
No. That's the stereotype, but that's not the case. I started my fund around the time I was actually in my late 20s when I was making the arrangements with the ECF, and I started it at around my 30th birthday, because then I told my friends and family, instead of giving me gifts, feel free to make a I kind of did my own little fundraising campaign to kickstart my fund. And then I figured it by hopefully by the time I turn 40, it will be active. I'll have raised that $10,000.
And but like you said, yeah. You got there early.
Yeah, I was it was before I turned 38 that it happened, so that which was great. I'm now 40, and so I'm a couple years into handing out the gifts from my fund. And
that's fantastic. We now know that you are moving out of Edmonton.
Yes.
So where are you going?
My retirement dreams are coming true early. I got married a few years ago, and my husband and I have often daydreamed about retiring to the island, to Vancouver Island. And then I thought, well, if we could get good jobs, why not start early? And so I threw it out there, and lo and behold, I managed to get, I think, a pretty darn good job. And so at the end of October, I'll be starting work as the Director of Advancement and Alumni Engagement, building up those programs at Camosun College, which is a community college in Victoria, about 18,000 students. So we are moving to Victoria, and this is after having spent 20 years in Edmonton. I grew up in Red Deer, 20 years in Red Deer, and now 20 years in Edmonton. And now, just a couple more weeks to go, and then I'll be on my way to Victoria for the next chapter. But I know I'll always be in touch with Edmonton. I have nothing but deep, deep love and admiration for this community, and pride for Edmonton, too.
Well, it's a huge loss for us. How does this change in your life change how you feel about your fund?
It was actually one of the things that I was contemplating when I made the decision. I kind of jokingly said that I know that the thing that excites me about endowment funds is they're forever, and that long after I'm gone, it will continue. And of course, I was talking about when I pass away. I didn't really mean it when I'm gone out of Edmonton, but now it's true. Like, when I'm gone from Edmonton at the end of this month, my fund will continue to make a difference in this community that I do love. And I know that every year I'll get to think about either causes that have for a long time been near and dear to my heart, or emerging needs in the community, or who knows what areas I'll be supporting. But I'm excited to know that I will continue to be able to make a difference in this city that I love, even when I'm gone, living the island dream in Victoria. I honestly hadn't planned for this, but it has worked out so well, and I'm so glad that it did. That my fund is active, that it is making a difference, and that will continue.
That's fantastic. Now, I just want to go back for one second.
Yeah.
Now, you outlined, you know, that you were able to get to your fund earlier than you expected in your planning. How easy is it to start a fund?
It is so easy. I would definitely say it is user-friendly. First of all, the staff at the ECF serve as great coaches and ambassadors, but there's no pressure. It's very much up to me. Like, you can set up the fund in various different ways. I chose for it to be entirely donor-advised and not locked in. Like, I can change my interests year to year if I so wish. Other people, I think, may want it always to support a certain cause. I know even here at the library, there's a fund that another donor had set up, and it will always support the library, and that's just the way it is. So I appreciate the flexibility, but the staff at the ECF help guide us through this. What I've also appreciated, as I've learned over the decade plus that I've been working with the ECF in this regard, is the staff have checked in with me periodically. Even before my fund went active, they would check in and make sure, like, is this still what I'm wanting? Is this still how I want it to be set up? That kind of thing. So I've really just appreciated the regular communications and guidance. So no, it was easy. And then I set up monthly donations, so it just came out like a regular bill almost. I think it was about $90 a month I had
going.
A positive bill. Yes. Yeah, a bill for good. $90 a month was just automatically withdrawn from my bank account and it would go into my endowment fund. It was kind of awesome. I'd get this giant, like over $1,000 charitable receipt with my taxes every year, just one. So it just was really, really user-friendly. And once it was set up, I didn't really even have have to think about it too much. So
anybody can do this.
Absolutely. This wasn't part of the plan. I didn't know I was going to be moving to Victoria anytime soon, but I'm so glad I have this fund because I love Edmonton, and it has been bittersweet preparing to leave this community. And one of the comforting things I have is knowing that this will continue to make a difference here. So,
and you will be missed. So well, we do appreciate you being with us today.
Oh,
thank
it's
you
a pleasure.
Very much. It's Emmy Steubing, and she is currently the fund development manager at the Edmonton Public Library, but she'll be leaving us shortly, and Edmonton's worse off because of it.
Oh, well, I'll be back, so I'll be visiting regularly, so you can't get entirely rid of me.
Thanks again to Emmy for joining us to talk about your fund and what it means to you. Your excitement about the community is contagious, and we wish you all the best.
We are nearing the end of our show, but before we go, we want to let you know about what is coming up here at Edmonton Community Foundation. We just have one grant application deadline to remind you about. The deadline to apply for our community grants program is December 1st, and that's to receive funding for projects after March 1st. Charities can be eligible for up to $40,000 to support their projects, and we highly recommend starting the process early. Coming up in the new year, we will be running the Endowment Sustainability Program, or ESP as we call it. This program is designed to provide a cost-effective training and coaching program to help organizations open endowment funds to ensure sustainable funding for their organization now and forever. ESP runs on the first Wednesday of each month from February to June for a total of 5 half-day classroom sessions. If your charity is interested in this training program, please visit ecfoundation.org for more information.
Coming up on December the 7th, Edmonton Community Foundation will be co-hosting the Mayor's Forum, Building Strong Communities. Come on out and join us on December the 7th to hear Mayor Don Iveson and Calgary Mayor Naheed Nenshi. They will be debating key issues to our two cities. Come on out and join us and get your tickets starting on November the 2nd. And that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you so much to each of our guests for joining us, and thank you for listening.
We've been your hosts, Andrew Paul
and Elizabeth Bonkink. Be sure to keep an ear out for our December edition of the Well Endowed Podcast next month. The Well Endowed Podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation
and edited by Lisa Pruden.
You can visit our website at wellendowedpodcast.com.
Subscribe to us on iTunes.
And follow us on Twitter at @TheECF.
Our theme music was created by Octavo Productions.
Check them out at octavoproductions.com.
And as always, don't forget to visit Edmonton Community Foundation at ecfoundation.org.
Well endowed.